right, so we're a few minutes behind.
Yeah. Well, you know, didn't really want to rush this one.
Do you think this is evidence that our subconscious does not actually want to do this?
Yeah, I think that's pretty much, you know, don't need to be a shrink to figure that one out. So here we are, expanding our horizon, Steve.
I hear what you're saying, but it's not making me feel any better.
Just use the discomfort. Use the discomfort. Go deep into it. What is it telling you? Your deepest desires? Your deepest fears? Oh, back. There it is.
All right. I guess we're here.
Oh, yeah. There's Pat.
All right. After you.
Hey, Pat.
So, we're here. Can you tell us what we're going to do?
We are going to get our nails done at a nail salon.
But we just realized that, like, everything we've done up to this point, we're like, yeah, this is going to be great. We're going to see, like, a really smash-em-up violent film, and it'll be funny, but it'll be great. And now we're, like, trying to take our own advice and, like, do things that are uncomfortable. And we're like, oh, that's uncomfortable.
What's uncomfortable all about it? It's the height of comfort. It's the definition of comfort.
Hi! All right, we are back from the nail salon, and this is the Pop Culture Salvage Expeditions. My name is Steve Lambert. I am here with Professor Dr. Stephen Duncombe.
Yep, that's me. And
Patricia Gerardo. Hello, everyone.
As you know, today we went to get a manicure. Some of us got pedicures at a nail salon in Brooklyn, and we brought along with us
a resident expert
in nail salons and manicures and pedicures. And she's amazing at a lot of other things.
Yeah, like being an activist.
Yes.
Like an amazing activist.
But
that's secondary, actually. We really brought her here because she's an expert in manicures and pedicures.
Yeah. And her name is Linda Sarsour.
Thank you guys for having me.
Hey, so Linda, can you tell our podcast audience a little bit about you?
My name is Linda Sarsour. I'm born and raised Brooklyn, New York. I am the executive director at the Arab American Association of New York and a racial justice and civil rights activist in New York City.
Fantastic. We got to know Linda at one of our trainings. And really why we did bring her is because at that training, she admitted that she had this incredible fondness for manicures and pedicures. And so when we were putting this together, we were like, okay, so who can we ask? And all of a sudden, all of us at the same time, we're asking Linda. She's coming. And she has an incredibly busy schedule, but she freed up some of her afternoon to go get a little self-care with us.
Yes, we did.
And now we all have beautiful nails. I'm looking at a real high gloss. My hands have never looked better.
Yeah,
gorgeous.
But I have to say, I was very uncomfortable doing this. This touched on a lot of sensitive points for me that I didn't know I had.
I think that it's called triggers.
Yeah, I was triggered. I was triggered by this.
I know it was a side of you I've never seen before.
I know, it's really weird.
The minute they said pick a color, he got traumatized.
Yeah, I was like, I don't want a color. Yeah, so this, I don't know, whose idea was this?
I don't know. I think we were thinking,
It was your idea.
On a list. It was on a list of ideas, yeah, that we came up with when we were thinking about doing this. And I thought this was at the bottom of my list.
Yes.
Yeah.
I thought
it'd be a long time before we did it.
Yeah, but I wanted to move it up because I think we're getting a little dude heavy with our list.
Yes.
You know, action, adventure movies.
TGI Fridays.
TGI. Oh, that's gender neutral, TGI Fridays.
Well, Lindo, I should explain what we do. Every time we do a show once a month and we pick something that is very popular that generally we wouldn't do otherwise. And then we go do that thing. We had a meal at TGI Fridays in Union Square. We saw Transformers Age of Extinction. We listened to music on the top Billboard Top 100.
And we went to our last one was we went to the Comedy Cellar.
Yeah. And then we talk about, okay, if this is popular and people like it, that means it's doing something. It's meeting needs for the for people. And those needs are met, but maybe not steered in the directions we'd like as activists, right? We want people to be engaged. We want them out there changing the world.
And, you know, as you know, as an activist, is we often just end up speaking to ourselves. And, you know, if we're going to bring about change in the world, we've got to be able to speak in a language that other folks understand. And obviously God agrees with us because there's thundering outside at this moment. And so with an emphasis from gods, the idea here is that we can tap into sort of popular sentiment and try to figure out, well, what is popular? What are the popular dreams? What are popular desires? And then take some of that and redirect it towards our activist ends.
And nail salons apparently are popular because there were three just on that. No, there were two on that block. The block before, there were three.
Mm-hmm.
They seem to be opening like crazy. Do you have any idea how where this comes from or how it got started? Just women how always have painted their nails, I guess.
Dude. So I've been amazed that nail salons have continued to prosper. Especially when you think that this is an activity that you can easily do for yourself, right? You can buy a $4 bottle of nail polish, sit yourself at home and do your nails, that we have as many nail salons as we do. I thought, especially after the 2008 crash, I thought, you know, this was definitely something we were going to see, you know, reduced, if not, you know, diminished. And I guess that's why I'm not on Wall Street doing investment information, because, yeah, this still surprises me that people pay money to do this.
Nail salons are a sanctuary. It's where you run away from your family, you run away from work, and you sit with some strangers that you've never seen before, and you sit back and someone's actually doing something for you and touching your feet. That takes a lot for, you know, to let someone just touch your feet, massage your feet, paint your toenails. And it's a very nice relationship that you have with a stranger that you get to see sometimes every other week or every month. I love it. It's the only thing that I do for myself as a act of self-care. So I think if we're going to connect this to activist world, we need self-care, and everyone defines self-care in a different way. And for me, this 20 minutes, 30 minutes of my life is very important, and I like to spend them at nail salons.
I love that description. I love that, a sanctuary to get away from it all. That's great. That just like opened up for me an understanding that I never had before.
But I've noticed like there that in the town I live in, like businesses close all the time. There businesses are only on Main Street. It's kind of a small town, but the nail salons, they might close, but another one opens. A new lash place just opened. There's like multiple hair salons. I want a better taco place, but they just keep opening nail salons and hair salons. So these things are popular and are in every neighborhood in the city. In every city I've ever visited, there's a nail salon.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that, you know, as Linda was talking about, you can get the idea of why. Is it really is not just a place that's a sanctuary, but a place where someone comes and takes care of you. So you don't just get away from your family, get away from your job, but you're actually put in a different place where you are the center of attention. I mean, this was my, I'll admit, it was my second time going and getting a mani-pedi. And I've got, by the way, beautiful black nails right now.
Yes, I just want
to say that.
Some with glitter.
So yeah, okay. Some with glitter. I didn't want to let that out, but okay. Some with glitter. But this time, it really struck me as like, not only did I get my cuticles done and all that, but there was a massage, there was a hand massage, a shoulder massage. Yes. And it really was this sense of I was the center of attention. Yes, I know I'm paying for it to be the center of attention. But for once, for someone who doesn't exist as someone who gets taken care of, but I take care of other people, someone was taking care of me. And that felt really good. Mm-hmm.
I was surprised at how much touching was going on. And even when I went to dry my nails, I thought it was over. And then someone comes over and starts giving me a back massage. It was just like, what's going on? Why all the touching?
Not normal?
You know, I don't go that often, but I never got a back massage while my while I was drying my nails. That seemed, yeah, that was new for me.
Linda, you go all the time. You said, what is it? You do a minimum once a month and you try to ramp it up twice a month. Was this, is this normal to have that sort of attention paid to you?
Well, the Park Slope ones are a bit more expensive and luxurious. I go to some in Sunset Park and in Bay Ridge, which are not as luxurious, but quite wonderful as well. I think, so it's pretty standard these days, the massaging of the feet, the hands. And then when you go to dry your nails, a woman or someone comes to you and gives you like that last 3 minute, like, we love you, come back next time. But I think when I think about it and we talk about, like you were saying, about like the economic downturn and kind of the stresses of life, I think that's why nail salons will always thrive. The more stress there is in the world, the more you need to de-stress. And these places mm-hmm. are de-stressors and they're reasonably priced. So you might not be able to afford a $115 massage at a massage parlor, especially one of the more high-end spas. Mm-hmm. But dropping $15 on a manicure once a month, and if you break that down, it's like 50 cents a day if you do it once a month. It's actually pretty reasonable
to
do that.
I've
broken it down. I've done the budgeting around this.
You had to rationalize.
And then you leave, and then there's a sense of like confidence when you leave there. Like you're walking around, you're like, these are my new toes and my new, you know, manicure, my new nails. I don't know. There's something spiritual about it.
Yeah. And I think that's important too, is you get to bring it with you. That is unlike to say a massage, you leave, you're back out in the world. I'm just glancing down at my fine looking black nails right now. And it's just sort of like, I took care of myself.
Yep.
And I'm important. And the stress of the day, stress of everything else can go around. But still, it brings me back to, I need to take care of myself.
See, that's a little bit of that is what makes me uncomfortable. And the amount of attention too, like having someone do something, like you were saying, it's so easy for me to do. Like I absentmindedly clip my nails in the bathroom. Like I'm not thinking about it. I'm just clip, 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 you know, needs to get done. And to have just to sit there, what was someone before me attending to my hands, like that really, I just like, I don't want that. I can do this myself. I don't want to make someone else do that. The other thing of course is, like it or not, I don't know how it happened, but I was raised with some pretty standard, I don't know if standard's the word, but like gender normative, whatever, upbringing. I don't think my parents intentionally tried to do that, but men don't paint their nails. Men don't have manicures done. So it's like, that was like, and it's deep down, it's deep in me, right? So knowing we were going to get a manicure. Oh, and also I just opted not to do the pedicure.
You did the manicure.
I did the manicure. Yeah. But I went up to my limits, but it was really like, I definitely cannot imagine even now, like having color on my nails. It would be embarrassing to me. There's that. And then the third part that I was like, oh God, I don't know if I can do this, is that there were these two big exposés in the Times, which Steve probably shouldn't have sent me before this.
Yes.
And it's about how terrible the workers are treated mm-hmm. in most of the nail salons in New York City. And then two, how toxic the environment is. Right. And I mean, just horrifying stories of miscarriages and stuff. And it's like, oh, I don't want to give any money to this. You know, it's like, I just don't want to participate in this at all. And those three things combined, it's just like, mm-hmm. this is not something at all I'm looking forward to. That said, halfway through, I was like, this is great. And I don't know why I've been denying myself this for so long, because I really like this. And I get it. I don't know that I'll do it again, but I get it.
So when the nail salon expose came out in the New York Times, and something that I thought about way before the New York Times ever wrote about it, I think I've gotten to see the red flags in the different nail salons that I visited. So the one that we visited today, I think is actually probably could be an example. And I'll tell you why. First of all, their manicures and pedicures are pretty reasonably priced, but still on the high end in comparison to some of the other salons.
The manicure was $13.
So in my one that I go to, it's $6. It's half price and it's only less than like 2 miles down from here in Bay Ridge. So
wow.
And that's why when you asked about the tip, I say give cash, because what we understand is that when you do card and you pay the tip on the card, it never actually gets to the worker that helped you. So my nail salon, I already asked this before to the boss. So the boss says any cash tips that they get is theirs. Mm-hmm. So that's why I gave, like in other salons, I give more of a tip. So I'll give my lady like $7 or $8 a tip because I know that the manicure is cheap. She's probably not getting paid well. She's basically making her living off of the tips. And it created a conversation. Like I was able to have this conversation at the nail salon that I've been going to for like 6 years and very shook up about it and trying to be very defensive about their employees. And there's been people that have been working there for the whole 7 years that I've worked there. They look pretty happy to me. The boss is a younger woman and I see some sort of camaraderie that's happening there. But I've thought about that nail salon stuff for a long time before the New York Times. And it was great that it came out. But I also felt bad for some of the immigrant business owners because they're not all terrible. And it kind of casted this wide net of like, these are all like slum employers when in fact, some of them are actually like the one that I go to, 5 women own it together. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there's 7 employees. So 5 of the 7 actually have an investment in that business.
It's like, right? A worker owned co-op.
It's it's like a 80% co-op there. So yeah. Wow. So that's why that place you can tell is probably paying their employees a little bit better because the way of the pricing. For example, color gel there was $50. I only paid $20. The $30 difference
So I asked that really important question. What color did you get your toes?
I got a very natural pink.
Very, very nice.
Trying to keep it on the, you know, a little bit subtle in Ramadan, you know.
Yeah. And Pat, I wouldn't say subtle was really characterized your choice.
No, I went for metallic silver. Yeah. My feet will stand out on the beach when I'm walking around.
And what is the color choice? How does that fit into all of this? I mean, you walk in there and on the right wall is literally like a showcase with must have been 50, 60 different colors.
You know, I usually, and I don't go that often, but when I do go, I usually bring my own nail polish because I have colors that I like to use. Mm. So I usually walk in with the color that I want, but I do love looking at all the choices. And, you know, that could just be another podcast and just, you know, makeup and makeup choices that exist. It is just, it's fun. Mm-hmm. It's fun.
I felt like, and definitely like, and I was choosing identity, right? I think somebody, I don't know which one of you said, oh, you should get the bright green. It's like, no, I'm not bright green. No way. And then they're like, you said red. And I'm like, no, I'm not red. And then am I orange? I'm not orange. But like you start to take that on, right? Like you have a set number of colors or you have your own palette that expresses you.
Mm-hmm. Well, the choosing of the color is actually part of the experience. It literally takes you into this mindless place of like choosing a color. I just forget about everything else. I'm literally like so concentrating on like, is it summer? Is it spring? Where am I going this week? What outfits am I wearing? Is there like a party? Is there a gala that I'm going to? You know what I mean? Do I got to do something professional? Like go to a meeting that's not an activist-y meeting situation. So it actually takes you to a whole different place. And the overwhelmingness of the colors is for me, like I spend a lot of time, like today I was a little, you know, cause it's Ramadan, I wasn't like, but usually I spend a lot of time being very like intentional about like what color I do and what season it is and does it go and what are my favorite colors and also what did I do last time? Cause you don't want to do what you did last time. Cause sometimes before I get there, I had already taken my nail polish off. Don't want to do two, you know, back to back of the same. So it takes you to a really mindless place. And I like going there sometimes.
Well, and I think that part of the mindless place is also represented in the magazines. Mm-hmm. Because this is something I know my wife always talks about when she gets a mani-pedi is like, yeah, I get to catch up on all the gossip.
Yes.
And so as you're getting your nails dried, and I noticed you did this, Pat, you were just like, put your hand right up for the magazines, you know? And so you're reading OK and Us and all of that. And it's like, really, did they do that? Did she? No. And it's, but there's no consequence to any of that. And so it's that part of that sort of mindless kind of, okay, I'm doing something. But I don't really, it doesn't really matter all that much.
Emil Clooney's pregnant.
No.
George Clooney's wife. I didn't know that.
I did not know that either.
And then they were bashing her saying that she was only 99 pounds. Who cares if she's only 99 pounds? She can still get pregnant. What's the problem?
Yeah.
I didn't know that until I went to the nail salon today.
There we go.
Yeah, a lot of those magazines were about how different people were doing something wrong.
That's what I noticed. Being pregnant at 99 pounds apparently is wrong.
You wore it wrong.
Yep.
This person wore it right. Like, oh, look, this, there, that's the Rock's tie flipped up in his face. Ha ha.
Yeah.
Which, you know, like I'm in this nail salon and I know I'm doing it right. Right. Like I look good. And then I can look at some people that look bad.
Right.
Some famous people that look
the
bad.
The fashion police arrested.
Yeah, exactly. So we talked about a couple things. We talked about this idea of the sanctuary, right? And this idea of a place where you get taken care of. We've also talked about the sort of choice and the idea of being able to look at what you've done and carry that with you and so on and so forth. So as activists, how do we take some of these lessons and actually put them into the field? And I'm like Pat, I'm really struck with the word that you used, which was sanctuary, right? And it seems like so much of the work we do as activists is absolutely not about sanctuary. It's like we are in the trenches getting pummeled left, pummeled right. And so, yes, we can escape from that and go to the nail salon. We can escape from that and go watch Transformers, The Age of Extinction. But is there any way we can actually build some of that into our activism, that sense of sanctuary?
For me, as someone who is in the trenches, I feel like going to something like the nail salon is a place to like stop for a second, because the fights I'm fighting are still going to be out there when I'm done at the nail salon. And it's also a place that I take other colleagues with me. Like a lot of times, my deputy director, one time we were at a meeting and it was like 3 o'clock and it was like, okay, we're back to the office. I was like, no, we're not going back to the office. You're coming with me. She's like, where are we going? I was like, well, wherever I go, I'm the boss. You go where I go. And I took her to a nail salon down in downtown Brooklyn. And I sat her down and I said, it's just pick a color. I'm going to tell the lady what to do. She was like, okay. She sat down and picked the color and I gave her a spa pedicure, which is a little bit more elaborate just so that, because she truly deserves it. And she was just a little nervous in the beginning, like, what is going on here? And then afterwards, I told her, I said, number one, you deserve this. Number two, all that paperwork on your desk is going to still be there tomorrow morning when you get there. And reminding people that you have to stop and take care of you, because if you're not taken care of, then we can't take care of all the other work that we're doing, including fighting injustices. So it sounds like, when you think about nail salons, it sounds like it's something really simple, but it's symbolism for this idea of self-care and the movement that no one really talks about. Like, we have to fight every day and we have to win. And sometimes I'm tired, like really tired, like physically exhausted. And I just want an hour. No kid, nobody call me, nobody talk to me, and just sit down in a chair and have some like weird robotic hands massaging my back. And it's, you leave there and it feels great and you feel good about yourself, and then you go back to work.
So what you're saying is, before we even get to like a metaphorical, what needs are this meeting? How do we meet that through activism? It's like, there's a literal value here of taking a break, taking some time out, taking care of yourself, and really not doing anything else. Like we saw in there, you know, like when you're having your hands sort of taken care of, you can't check your phone. You can't read a magazine. Mm-hmm. And if you're in there alone, there's really no one else to even talk to. You just have yourself taken care of, and that's important too.
The leap for me, though, trying to think of how to bring this into activist culture, is that it's part of what Steve was pointing out before, is it's not just the taking care of ourselves, which we frame it that way, but it is letting someone take care of us, which I think is where we have the difficulty, right?
Yeah.
That is where it's just like, well, no, I can do it myself. No, I can do my own nails. I can do my own feet. I can do my own massage. And how do we get comfortable in spaces where we allow people to take care of us?
Yeah, because one of the things I was thinking about is, okay, I'm feeling really creeped out by I'm paying someone to take care of me. And then I realized, wait a second, this costs $13. This person can then go and be taken care of themselves. And so this idea of sort of reciprocal caretaking is that, unlike sort of an economy of the 1% and the 90%, where the 1% get taken care of and the 90% get nothing, this sort of low-cost self-care is a way of thinking about that care is something that everybody can get from someone else. Mm-hmm. And it's not about equality. Mm-hmm. That is, at that moment, someone is taking care of me. But at another moment, I, in some way or form, can be taking care of someone else. And that sort of cycle is something we might want to be striving for.
Linda, do you feel like in the work that you do, that part of what you do is taking care?
The work that I do every day is about taking care of other people. I run a social service agency and I get to see that every day. But I think on the in the context of the nail salons for me, and I really think deeply about these things. They're nail technicians. Like this is a skill that they have. It's a profession. You know that they went to some sort of trade school or something to get these licensure. And for them, it's a point of pride. Like a lot of the women that do my nails, they're very proud of the work that they do, and they always ask me afterwards, like, "Do you like it? Is it nice? Like, this is a product that they created for you." Mm-hmm. And they carry it with pride. And I think that we sometimes think about them sometimes in this kind of like, you know, we're the patrons and they're the like service people. But this is a skill that they have, that they are giving to the world. And we don't think about it in that way. So like when I'm there, like I don't see them as lower than me or they're touching my feet. They are people with skills who are offering a service that I'm paying for, that I want to pay for, and they are proud of themselves and I'm proud of taking care of myself. And there's some sort of mutual, like, unspoken understanding of the relationship that you have in a nail salon with these folks. Like for me, when I walk in there, they're just like walking into a doctor's office. They are professionals to me. Mm. And if we think about them in that way, I think then the experience isn't as challenging for people, because they are there because they want to be there. They went and got trained. They could have done hair. They could have been working anywhere else, but they chose that type of profession. So they're my professionals that I get to interact with.
I'm going to just cycle back for a second and talk about in our movements how we don't care for each other, and in fact how we often sort of push each other to see the sacrifices that we can make. And I don't mean just push other people, but push ourselves into a place of like, I'm more committed than you are. I'm going to be here till 12 o'clock at night. I'm going to get up super early and make the phone calls that I have to do. And that's the way I'm going to show my commitment. And I'm just struck by like, how is it that we've gotten into that cycle, which then of course leads to one of two things. Either you burn out or you become this person which is so masochistic that you actually can't relate to anybody else, because most other people actually like pleasure and they like to take care of ourselves. So like, how do we bring the care back in to our activist lives?
I mean, I think about my old, like, growing up friends on my street. None of them are anything like me, and I have a hard time relating to them. Like, they do things like, you know, meet for coffee and do, like, I don't know, pleasurable things. I don't know.
Oh my God.
Like go to a spa for a day, like with their, you know, with other friends, or, you know, leave their husbands at home and do like a girl's night out or whatever. I watch some like post stuff on Facebook and I get even a little bit like judgmental, like really, like girl's
people
night
are
out.
Dying.
Yeah.
People are dying.
That's me. I'm like, and then I go look at what people post on their Facebook. I'm like, all this stuff that's happening, that's all you can do. Like you just bought a new bag today. Like, and I try not to do that. But I think we need to bring back self-care and encouraging each other to do self-care and telling somebody like to go home, which I think is the simplest act of caring for others. Like when you're at the office and you're just like, wait a minute, it's 7 o'clock. Like you need to pack your stuff and go home. And sometimes the way you do that is by packing your own stuff and walking out with that person. So you're encouraging them. And I think in the movement right now, it's just so much stuff. It's like so overwhelming. And because people see that there's like this urging, this crisis, like it's crisis, like people are dying, people are getting killed, like tomorrow that's going to happen again. And it's kind of like, look, people, this has been happening. We're going to fight for it to not to happen anymore. But in the meantime, we need to be alive to make that not happen. So I think it's not, I'm starting to see a lot more of it in the Black Lives Matter movement. A lot more people who dub themselves Black Lives Matter activists are actually pretty intentional about that. And I really love it. This idea of like self-care and calling each other up and being like, why are you here? Like, go take care of yourself. So I think it's starting to be, we're seeing progress.
In this community activist group that I was part of in the mid-1990s, Lower East Side Collective, one of our steady working groups was called the Ministry of Love. And the sole purpose of the Ministry of Love was to spread love around. They were to plan the parties. They were to meet people who came to our meetings. They were to call them later, check in with them. They were to make sure that our meetings didn't go on too long. They were to make sure that we basically had fun. And, you know, people would rotate through it. So all of us were in the Ministry of Love at one time or another. But I thought that was sort of a really brilliant idea, is to just say, this is actually part of the movement. Mm-hmm. That we need to love each other. And we kind of, because, you know, it was the 90s, we made it ironic and called it the Ministry of Love, but the intent was very serious.
Especially as a Black person in America, my thinking has always been, my longevity is my political act, mm-hmm. right? That's giving it to the man. And so I've always had that in my consciousness as something, yeah, I need to live long. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I need to do.
We in my organization, and I'm thinking about how to translate this back into the larger movement. We have something called the Sunshine Committee, and the Sunshine Committee is basically made up of staff members and some of the long term, like AmeriCorps members, people who are long term interns. And their whole job is, first of all, they don't forget your birthday. They keep track of your like yearly anniversary that you went working there. Oh. And then they do something where randomly it could be, it's like every month or sometimes every 6 weeks, randomly it's your day at the office. So you walk into work one morning and then you find your face plastered everywhere. And it says like, thank you, Kayla. And then you walk into your office, it's closed. You open the door and there's like balloons and stuff all over your office. And people think it's really simple. But if you see the faces of the people that are like busting their butts every single day, I mean, especially our caseworkers, they work literally from the minute they walk in till they leave. And then you walk into work and you're like, wait a minute, I have a hard job, but someone appreciates me and someone, I'm feeling loved, I'm feeling embraced. It's so profound. Like people have no idea the impact that it has on individuals. So I highly recommend the Sunshine Committee to the larger movement.
That's the kind of thing where even if you knew tomorrow's my day and there's going to be pictures of me all over the place, like still going to feel good when you walk right. in and you see that, you know? I think I came from this a very hard working work ethic kind of family, you know, where I remember sleeping at my parents had a small business and they also came out of the church where it was like all about sacrifice, you know? But sleeping in the office while they tried to finish jobs, you know, and our vacations were never like very long. We went to campsites cause they cost $6, you know, part of it's being broke. Part of it though was having your own business. And if you're not finishing jobs, money isn't coming in, but also part of it, you know, I don't think they always were the greatest at slowing down and like turning things off. It got passed on. I still have those problems too. But I think thinking about how we can do it for ourselves, how we can do it for other people is really key. And one of the things I was also thinking about, one of you guys said about walking out with this pride, right? Like you leave the nail salon, shoulders a little bit worked out, you know, like some of that's worked out and feeling good, feeling proud of how you look. And maybe we can't like do something that alters people's physical appearance, but I think there are things that we could do that affect people's sense of pride. Some of that's in the very nature of the work. Like inherently in work around Black Lives Matter, you're building up that sense of pride and value in the community. But even things that aren't as directly related, like what are ways we can have people leave an action, leave a meeting, leave whatever we're asking them to do, feeling that sense of pride.
Yeah, feeling good instead of feeling exhausted. Instead of thinking, oh man, all the stuff I got to get done, man. We'd walk out and say, yeah, I did something. And it matters. And I'm going to carry that mm-hmm. sense with me.
I think what's beautiful about Black Lives Matter movement is that this idea that it is about life matters and about the value and the sanctity of life, right? So that's already the premise. It's the foundation. So you already start from a good place. And what's awesome about it is that like all of the meetings that we have, we end meetings with, you know, this Assata Shakur quote, which is about, it is our duty to fight. It is our duty to win. We must love and support one another. We have nothing to lose but our chains. And the idea is that you do it together. You do it in a low voice and then a medium voice and a really loud voice. And you're holding hands and it's like a big family. And then you just, there's a lot of like love in the air and a lot of like, I got your back, you got my back. And I think the other thing is doing visible appreciation. Like we think we don't do this work for the appreciation, but at the same time, like it feels really good when your colleagues appreciate you in the movement. And especially when you're doing it publicly in front of other people, like people see that love that you're giving that other person and people yearn for that. And they say, oh, I want to be part of this group. I want to be part of this movement and get that same kind of love. And also encouraging each other. Like when I see colleagues of mine nationally who are like on the front page of Ebony magazine. That's a big deal. We don't get mm-hmm. on Ebony magazine covers. I want to blast that everywhere. I want to show that person how we are recognizing their work and that they shouldn't feel like they're becoming celebrities, that they're being recognized for the risk-taking that they're doing and the work that they're doing. So I think there are ways to just make people feel special.
Well, that feels good because I just realized I did that to you earlier when I tried to make you celebrate the victory of getting the Muslim holidays on the New York City school district, which last year you were fighting for and this year you won. And you were like, no, no, there's so many lost. Linda, you won. So I'm already on it. I can feel pride about myself.
My daughter swears to God that that was all her. At a 2013 mayoral candidate forum, she was 9 years old. In the fourth grade, she was actually in the third grade when this happened because it was 2013. Yeah. She got up. All of them were there. All the six major Democrats that were run and then the independent candidate. She literally stood up and was like, I have a question. And she, I have it on video. She asked this question directly to the panel. She was like, look, we've been working on this. We asked Mayor Bloomberg and he said, hell no. And what are you going to do when you become mayor? Am I going to have to choose between going to school and being with my family and blah, blah? I was like, oh, my God. And you know what? Every single candidate on that stage was like, you need to run for mayor. And I'm going to make sure that happens. And then Bill de Blasio becomes the mayor and kind of was on the record. So you kind of not have to do it. And then when it happened, she's like, see, I told you. Told you. Let me told you. I was like, okay.
But you got to have a party at the office. I hope you did when that happened. Because you guys were fighting for, like you said, 8 years.
There was a lot of crying and stuff. I mean, in a community like ours, that doesn't win much. We win like maximum security prisons in Guantanamo. So getting to shut down the largest public school system in the country is a pretty big deal for a community like ours. So it was really a humbling experience. But it also taught people like, this is power of the people. This is what happens when you organize and you mobilize and you're consistent and you believe in something and you can build coalitions. Like, you win stuff. So now they know that they can win, then I can make them want to win other stuff. See, that's all I needed.
And to bring it full circle, I suggest that, you know, one suggestion is, you know, maybe a mind shift in realizing that our activist spaces are those sanctuaries for people. And that... Oh. The, you know, because the idea of not doing something, you know, in this world with everything that's going on for so many people is a worse fate than anything. So if we thought of our spaces as places, oh, people are coming out to this as their sanctuary, how would that change how we start welcoming and getting participation of people?
That's great, because it's the move from, hey, you're willing to sacrifice just like I'm willing to sacrifice, into... Yeah, it's harder not doing this. And so let's come in and we can let some of that load off our shoulders. We can have sort of the great spirit of social justice massage our shoulders as we do this work and paint our nails.
And when we start meetings now, I feel like something that we've brought into the space that's important that brings you to that place, which is, why are you here? And when every single person shares their name and why they're there, there's some sort of thing that happens in the room. So you get to look across the room and say, oh, they're there for, you know, whatever. And I'm there because of the same reason. And then it creates a special relationship that I never really, I felt like every time I used to go into a room that I was there and I was expected to be a soldier to work. Like, what are you here to give me? What can you put on the table? Versus the opposite of like, why are you personally here? Like, what's your story? Like, who are you? Like, versus, I don't care who you are. I just know that you're here to work. And that's kind of been a lot of what I've seen in the movement. But up until the past maybe 2 years or so, I felt like people cared who I was as a person. I wasn't just another, you know, another pair of boots on the ground. I was an actual human being with a story that aligned, and that's why I was there.
That also describes a certain kind of ritual, you know, that I think sometimes we maybe are reluctant to bring into our activist meetings or activist practices because it feels a little contrived. It's like, well, we don't need to do that. This is serious business, you know, but it has a purpose, you know, and whether it's you're in a recovery group or a religious meeting or something, there's a way that it opens. There's usually some point where people introduce themselves or say hello to their brothers and sisters and, you know, among them and shake hands, peace be with you, that kind of stuff in Christian churches. And then a closing, right? Everyone says amen, or everyone says namo if you're Buddhist or whatever, you know, like there's a chant. And there's a collective action that makes you feel like you're in a group that's supportive. And we need to do that too. You know, like we can't have people come and leave a meeting without shaking hands with anyone or without being patted on the back and said, being told, thank you for making it out. There's other things they could do.
And there's also technology helps, right, in building a new kind of synergy in the movement that hasn't been there before. So, for example, I'm with a group called the Justice League NYC, and we have a GroupMe. And
what is a GroupMe?
GroupMe
sounds a little illicit.
Yeah, GroupMe, yes. It's Ramadan, Steve, man. Gotta stay focused. So GroupMe is basically an app. It's like a texting app. So you're not like on a group text. It's a little, it's kind of to the side. So it's not like blowing up your phone. You can kind of go to it and come back whenever you feel like it. Some people have notifications, others. So if it was just a group text, then I would be getting a text message all day and it would be crazy. So GroupMe is that kind of opportunity to stay connected to a group of people. You could have anywhere from like 5 people to 50 people on it. And what I love about it is that it keeps you connected to those people all day long, every day, and we become like a family. So people now, it's graduation week, their sisters are getting, you know, their kids, and people are like sharing these photos. And I think they got to a place where we just feel so connected to one another that we're not just there to, you know, fight the man. We're there to be, we're humans, and we have short stories to share and families to share.
Yeah. And what I like about that, it's really about acknowledging that we're not just activists. We're parents, we're friends, where people are going to go to a party or something like that. And it's about kind of acknowledging that activism is part of this whole grand life, which includes pleasure. It includes getting your nails done. It also includes picketing the mayor. And that's yes, part of this whole sort of thing, which makes us activists and can keep us activists for, you know, as Pat said, for as long as you can live. Because that's really the best revenge on the system is just, you know, stay a hellraiser and not burn out.
I just realized that we do this when we, like, the first time I met you was in a bar, you know, and maybe that's more
and the,
masculine.
And the last time I meet you, will probably be in a bar.
But
what does that say about us, Steve?
I've been in many meetings with, you know, groups of a certain kind of activists that happen in bars in New York City, and stuff gets talked about and planned. And that also, there, it's acknowledging that we don't just have functional relationships, right? We have like really, we're whole human beings, and we have relationships that are more complete than just.
Yeah.
What did they call that in Chicago? The they had a term for that kind of
the Iraq Veterans Against the War.
No, the religious group, Mackey's group.
Being at table.
Being at table.
Yeah.
And then there was something that they were not doing, which was like transactional.
Not transactional. Exactly. Transformative.
Yes. Nice. And transactional. You guys probably know this is like when every relationship you have is like, what can I get from you? What can, very political in a way, and like, you know, how we understand politicians to be.
So you know Mackey too.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Of course.
He's leaving us. He's going to
Costa Rica.
Costa Rica.
I know.
Good for him.
I can't imagine him and Nick in Costa Rica. Not at all. There's no nail salons on the beach.
You don't know that.
There probably are, exactly. But I do think that idea of the transactional versus the transformative is really important. And I'll just say, you know, when Steve and I work together, when we're only doing the transactional, when we don't get to go to like a barbecue place or something like that.
When we're working together.
When we're working together. It just, it becomes like, yeah, we get a lot of work done, but we actually come up with the best ideas actually when we're like, I'm working under my car. And we're talking about
As we were yesterday. Yeah, we finished our writing day, and then we installed a tow hitch on Steve's station wagon.
Exactly. And I think that that's something we have to just think about, because I like about that model is it expands who we are as activists, and it kind of bleeds into our everyday lives. But it also works the other way, as our everyday lives become part of our activism as well.
Which also, I mean, this is something that I think a lot about and work with people on. Activists are very unique in this, right? Because for someone working in a corporate setting, you don't want that to happen, right? You do not want them to blend their personal into what they're doing, right? Because
it's less efficient.
Yeah, people need to leave their work in that way. And activists have a very unique situation in opportunities to, you know, and even a desire to blend the personal and the political, right? In the same. And so it becomes, where do you set up the boundaries? Where are the boundaries for you? I mean, that's a longer conversation than we're going to get to in this podcast, but it is something that I'm always interested in talking to people and seeing how they kind of figure that out of how to have both that connectivity and then the important alone space as well.
Yeah, because that really brings us back to what Linda started with, that part of the beauty of the nail salon is that it's actually not part of her activist life. It's actually a place which is completely cut off. And sometimes, even in the most loving activist world, we just want to be alone. Mm-hmm. We just don't want to think about social justice or social injustice. We really want to think about celebrity gossip. We want our nails done. We want someone to take care of us. And that is part of our being as well.
And then there's something, too, in that it's not a complete withdrawal. There was a guy that I, when I went to grad school for art, he was a painter named Mike Henderson. Great guy. Still friends with him. And he came to San Francisco from Missouri and became a Black Panther, right? Like, I don't know if he was officially outfitted and had a membership card, but he was working with the Black Panthers. And his paintings back then, if you look them up, are like really violent, like images of police brutality, cops beating up protesters, blood squirting across the canvas, you know. And when I met him, there was no evidence of this rage in him anymore. And I was like, Mike, you know, I was kind of teasing him. I was like, what happened? You know, like, your paintings used to be about stuff. Now you just make these abstract color things. Like, what happened? And he's like, well, one day I just decided to live like we'd won, which was awesome. And I'm like, fair enough. You know, like, you did your part. You definitely contributed. But for him, that meant I'm going to live completely independently of this. I'm going to do exactly what I want. And in a way, withdrawing from politics, which that's his choice, right? But what you're talking about is taking, instead of working yourself for, you know, decades, having all this rage, and then in a way retiring, is to have your little sabbaticals throughout the month or every month, you know, where you take these moments so that you can return.
Or you could think about it how Audre Lorde thinks about it, which is, she says, caring for myself is not self-indulgence. It is self-preservation. And that is an act of political warfare.
Nice.
So you're still being an activist, taking care of yourself and engaging in a revolutionary act.
Yep.
Bam.
Okay. So before we finish, I just want to ask you guys if you have any new things or things that you're excited about or interested in about that are related to pop culture that you maybe want to recommend people check out. Pat, I know Empire's over. I'm really curious what you're going to come up with now.
Oh, for me, it's Inside Out. I saw it this past weekend, the latest Pixar film.
Right.
Yeah.
It is magical. The way that it deals with emotions, and it works on every single level for the kids, for the teenagers, for the adults. And I just loved it. I love the complexity that they are able to get across to a mass audience. They were dealing with depression and loss and, yeah, all these complicated things within a kid's cartoon that was engaging, just so beautifully done, well-told story. I mean, I would love to do a campaign like a Pixar movie.
All right.
I've been watching Supernatural with my family every night. And Supernatural, it's not a great show.
I don't know what it is. Okay,
so Supernatural is basically these two brothers who go around, and they're ghost hunters, basically, right?
Is it reality TV?
No, it's a drama. It's a drama, and it's pretty low budget. But what's important about it is that it's completely fan-based. And so there's more fan fiction and fan sites around this show than any other show. And then the writers actually take their ideas and put them into the show. And so you really get this sense of that there's lots of inside jokes. There's lots of sort of back and forth between the audience and the directors and the producers and the people that are writing the script. And so I just kind of love the idea of the sort of porousness between the audience and the producer. Mm-hmm. And even if you're not a fan, it's a pretty fun show to watch.
How do they let people know that they take those ideas?
Well, they actually don't. And that's what's kind of neat about it, is that if you don't know, for example, I didn't know when I first started watching this, it's a good show. And then later you find out through the fan sites and so on that they suggested this idea and they're running with that idea and so on and so forth. So it's working on a lot of different levels for a lot of different audiences simultaneously.
Hmm. So mine is Home Depot. Me and my significant special lady friend partner bought a house. First time. I've never done this before and never thought it was possible, but somehow we managed to do it. And now I'm in the world of people who own homes and have to fix them themselves. I've noticed at Home Depot, like, it is a hugely creative place. There are so many decisions that are really are creative and artistic decisions that people make around where they live. Not everyone, you know, some people just go default shag carpet, whatever cabinets are the cheapest, that kind of thing. But there are so many different creative decisions, and it really is like the palette is your home, and figuring out what kind of surroundings you want to live in is such a major artistic decision that these everyday people are making, and it's all happening like based out of this, you know, chain store warehouse. I'm still wrapping my head around it.
So I'm looking forward to July 26th, which is the Bay Ridge Arab American Bazaar. It's a creative spectacle of Arab culture and heritage in a very largely concentrated Arab community. And it's for me, I think in this day and age, in this time, it's a political act of resistance of saying we are here in this community. We have live stage, live music blasting from like two avenues up, dance performances, food. The whole community comes out, plus our friends, and it's a wonderful and it's a event. It's that one time event of the year that I look forward to, even though it requires a lot of work and fundraising and all that. But once you're there, it's worth every second of it. So I'm looking forward to that.
What's the date again?
July 26th, Sunday, July 26th in Brooklyn, New York.
All right, where in Brooklyn?
Shore Road Park out in Bay Ridge. So you can ride your bike down there. It's right over the bay water. It's beautiful.
Nice.
Something to do. Food, good food.
Middle Eastern food. Delicious. Everything.
Okay.
A little
All right.
self-care for the belly.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, Linda, I want to say thank you for being our guest. You are a superstar in the world of activism. You've shaken Barack Obama's hand, right?
And he gave me an award weeks after I tore him up. Online. Hey, see, democracy.
And you've won many battles and are fighting many more. And so thank you for taking some time out to come and talk to us and show us around some nail salons. And so, Linda, if you want to listen to this show, it's on iTunes. You can tell everybody. And if you subscribe, you will get it every week. And you can find notes for this show. So we'll put like a link to the bazaar that you talked about and the Pixar movie that Pat talked about and all that stuff on the Artistic Activism site. So, you know, we can include videos and notes and you'll find all the other episodes of the show there. Thank you again for joining us.
Thank you.
And we'll see you next time.
All right. Till then.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Keep an eye out for our next episode. We're going to be answering letters from listeners like you, but we also are going to have a couple of very exciting special guests.
Well, yeah, you, like what Sid said, it's like, are you going to edit that stuff out?
You can edit whatever you want.
Okay, can we restart on, what's the question again?
Next month's show is on the game Minecraft. See you then.